My name's Betty, I'm an addict.
Hi, Betty.
See, I'd like to say that I think the first time that I met Bill was when I moved out to the valley, and we started going to, Jimmy and I started going to some meetings where Bill had a place there, and you know, I heard about all the addicts that were coming out of this place and were getting a lot of good recovery, and Bill always stressed NA, and a lot of people are clean today because of a lot of what Bill has done through the years. You know, he and Jimmy were very close, and yeah, it's kind of a special place in my heart. But I'd like to introduce you to Bill. Okay?
Getting tired of hearing from me, but I'm going to talk anyway. I was trying to think about this. You know, it's been all this stuff about history, and maybe I'll just talk about a little my history now. Probably be a little bit of an idiot log, a little bit of a drug log, and but I don't know, you know, I'm going to kind of start in a weird place, somewhere along the line of recovery, having to do with writing inventories and discovering about oneself. And I think I made the discovery that my addiction started at approximately age 3, a long time before I ever took any drugs. It had to do with some kind of a way of thinking. I don't think I was ever what you would call a normie. Yeah, I might have liked to have been a normie. But then most of my life I never even had any inkling to be a normie. And when I look around out there today, I don't think I really want to be a normie. Right? It's kind of nice to be a little weird and be able to be individualistic. And so as I went through school, my family moved around a lot. The Second World War years, and then at the end of the Second World War, we moved even more. My dad had a weird occupation, went around converting volunteer fire departments into full-time fire departments. And not only that, it was a periodic drunk who went from the stages of self-righteousness and to the complete depths of degradation, you know. Like, either he'd be up there listening to Beethoven and kicking the shit out of me with his belt, you know, because I didn't put the rake marks properly in the ground, you know. When raking the yard, one must make straight rake marks. And then, on the other hand, we were go down and peel him out of Skid Row occasionally because he'd been on 6 months drunk, and we had to be ahead of the sheriff, you know. I lost all that prestige in the community that you can imagine a fire chief gets, you know. And, you know, being a kid, you know, I didn't understand that, you know. And I roll into a new town, and in those days it wasn't fashionable to have divorces, you know. They people thought you should get married and stay married forever. Some people may still think that way today. I think they're swinging more back around that way. But as I would go to these different schools, I'd be talking about, well, my mom this, my mom that. But we lived here and we did that. And everybody just figured I was a goddamn liar, you know. So I wasn't compatible with anybody's particular lifestyle at that time, you know. I think nowadays people are more nomadic in nature and they're moving around and doing all kinds of things. But at that time it was a big traumatic thing, going from school to school. And so as I get to these new schools, you know, I had that need to be accepted just like anybody else. But, you know who, the first people were to accept me was the fuck-ups. You know. So, and I was willing to go right along with that. I mean, I just went right along with that little, thing, you know, and, so in spite of the fact that as a little toddler I said, you know, I'll never drink because my dad is a periodic alcoholic, and I'll never do, I mean, everything I said I'll never do, you know, I guess I wound up doing it, you know. So, it seemed to be that it was a natural course of events for me to fall into doing a little drinking, and in those days it was considered to be a little wild to take some bennies along with the booze. You could stay up and party a little better and a little longer. They didn't have a lot of the exotic drugs and things that they have nowadays. But I was as sure a shoe-in for them as they came along, I'll tell you. And then we began to smoke a little weed. But, it, you know, you actually had to know somebody in those days. I mean, you had to know somebody, you had to know a musician or somebody that talked out the corner of their mouth or somebody that walked funny, like Father said last night, you know, and it was all about walking that walk, talking that talk, you know. So we'd smoke that stuff and turn on the funny colored lights and drink some booze, and somewhere along the line, somebody told me, oh, I know what it was. I really love weed. I mean, you've got to understand how I used to smoke weed. Most people smoke a joint and lay it down, you know what I mean? I smoke a joint. If I decide to smoke weed, I'm going to start scoring by the kilos, because I'd smoke anywhere from 20 to 50 joints a day, every day, you know. And that was throughout my whole drug-using history. The fact is, I became more panicked about getting weed than I did heroin. You know, heroin, it was kind of foregone conclusion, right? You wake up in the morning, you feel shitty, you go do what it is you have to do. Rob, steal, or whatever, you know. But when you're out there trying to support X amount of dollar a day habit, and then all of a sudden you realize you got to score, you know, 3 kilos of weed just to feel secure, you know. Because I was, you know, I mean, I was really crazy compared to a lot of other people. It's, I mean, things were like real serious, you know. I mean, like I did, you know, 30 months in a federal penitentiary for 2 joints in those days, and felt grateful, because they had people doing 15, 20 years, and they used to jump on you. And I know a guy that, you know, got about 15 years because he had a little flake on his tooth, and they'd come and get the little out of your pockets with a vacuum, and people would even go to jail for seeds. So here I'm in there doing these years in the penitentiary for a couple of joints, but I thought I was really, really lucky. But I figured, well, I'm in the wrong place at the wrong time. And so anyway, I give you that part of my marijuana thing. I ran into a guy, and he was going to cop me some weed, right? And I gave him the money, something you don't generally do, but I kind of trusted this guy, so I gave him the money out front. Well, he came back and he said, you know what, I couldn't score, but I scored some stuff. And in those days, it used to come in them little number five caps, little capsules. And, you know, you just break one of them capsules open and knock a little, about the size of a match head off the top, like you couldn't walk for a week, man. It was bad shit, you know. This guy gave me this little, well, it wasn't a little bottle, it was kind of a bottle about yay big with all these little capsules in there, and he told me, he said, I don't want you to think I burned you, so I'm going to let you hold this, and within 2 days I'll bring your weed, you know. And so I thought, well, I'm going to try some of this stuff, and I broke some out, put it on my thumbnail. I said, I heard they snort this stuff. And, you know, and I did that. And then the guy came back, half the bottle was gone. You know, I was... I told the guy, hey, how much of this stuff can you use before it grabs your ass? And he said, looks to me like it's too late. And, you know... and he says, as a matter of fact, you're wasting it. He said... let's stop in this gas station here and I'll show you how to use it, you know. So, you know, he introduced me to a spoon and some toilet water, and away we went. My life was never the same after that, you know. So, you know, the ongoing saga of addiction, you know. And but I want to say something that might have been maybe just a little bit unusual for a lot of addicts, but I was what you call a functioning addict for many, many years. While I was in the penitentiary, some guy had explained to me that holding a job was the key to staying out of jail, and he says, but you'll never be able to get a job because you're too stupid. And he said, the other thing is, that when you fill out the application, they're not going to want to hire you because you're an ex-convict. So he said, I'm a barber in San Francisco, so let me tell you, why don't you go become a barber? So I said, well, how do you do that? And he says, well, you take the comb, you take the scissors, and you go like this, right? And I thought, well, fuck, I can do that, man. And, so then I got out of jail, and I was on parole, and they sent me up to the mountains, one of these places where my father was being on his self-righteous thing. And I couldn't handle that, so I got a job in a bar cleaning the toilets at night. And then I noticed that the bartender left his little, he'd get drunk and hide the sacks of money. So... I said, I gotta get out of here, man. It is, you know, like I'm not from the mountains, you know, right? So I took his little sack of money and I went off to become a barber. And I did, I somehow did that. And then I found out I didn't have to fill out any employment applications, and it didn't take a whole lot of talent to be able to go into that business, you know, just rent a hole in a wall, get a stool and a mirror, you know, and you were in business, you know. So there I was doing this thing, you know, and then I figured out, well, if I want to make more money, I got to have other people work with me, so I put in more chairs, and so what I used to do, though, is I take all the money that came in and go buy dope with it, you know, so then they take my barber shop away from me, you know. So consequently, I had about 200 or 300 barber shops. And these people always be real surprised because I had gone somewhere and, in all my travelings around and I had joined a Masonic lodge, right? So I put on my Mason pin and my three-piece suit. And I'd go out there and I'd walk up to some guy that had a shop for sale, and I'd give him a hot check and move in the next day, you know. So then I'd give him a few dollars back. I'd tell him, well, you don't understand, the escrow got screwed up, so here's a few dollars on that check, but now I've made it a debt instead of a crime, you know. And he was stuck with me, and so was the landlord and everybody else, right? Now I had me a till that I didn't have to worry about robbing somebody else's till. I could rob mine all day long, man. And as soon as $20 got in there, I was gone, man. And then it got even more insane than that. I found out if I hired dope fiend barbers, they didn't ask too many questions, but they were trying to rob the till too. So here we are. Here we are in business, local businessman, 32nd degree Mason, and out in the supermarket robbing and stealing and doing whatever, you know, the cat burglar by night. Whatever you got to do to use is what went on. But I was able for many, many years to hold this image, and that image did keep me out of jail for many, many years, you know. But then I had my trunk full of all this marijuana, you know. I mean, all I can remember on a customer's, man, be leaning on a customer's like this, you know. I mean, for real, you know, I'd nod out, go to sleep, and right in the middle of a haircut, you know. And somewhere along the line, I picked up a magazine, and I read in this magazine that they were curing addicts and alcoholics with LSD. And so I said, well, I know, you know, I think I heard of a guy. Fact is, he was the same guy that had me hold the heroin years before, right? And I said, but I know this guy over here. He's got some stuff. It looks like Micron mouthwash, you know. Well, I'm going to try some of that stuff. So, you know, I never just bought one of anything anyway, so I just went over and bought me like about a half a gallon of that shit and proceeded to take a bath in it. I know the first night that I took some, I thought I got burned, you know. I mean, I wasn't quite as heavy as I am now, but I've been pretty fat most of my life off and on, and different times I've lost, you know, 100 pounds or so. This particular time, I'm probably 250 pounds, and we got this stuff, and I drank this little vial of that stuff, and it's riding along in a car stop for a stoplight. I told the guy, I got to get out and move around a little bit, and I got out of the car, and I start jogging. I come, well, I'm just going to jog a block or two, you know, and you guys... I'm out there, man, running about 5 miles, hollering about that son of a bitch burning me, man. Look at this, man. You know, I said, and the trees are going, and the street lights, you know, and these people are hollering, get in a car. You know, Jesus Christ, you're going to get us busted, you know. We're going to drive off and leave you. And finally, I think a couple of them got out of the car and shoved me back in the car. We went over to this place, and yeah, we're all supposedly hardcore heroin addicts, and we're all sitting there kicking this little kid's toy that had a bell on it going ding ding, you know, and this is going on all night. I mean, the hours went like that, you know. But then I thought, well, hell, there's nothing to this stuff, you know, so... Then I used that, and I got a little more goofy, had some out-of-body experiences and all kinds of weird stuff. And then I decided, well, you know, I don't see the cure happening, right? I'm still fixing. The people are running around with the Dilatas and, you know, all the stuff. And I'm in fact, I had this little pretty little blonde that was... you know, she was a barber and a hairstylist, too, and we were both looked like dogs, you know. And I'm telling her, I said, man, this cure ain't working, you know. Maybe, I hear they got some in the pill form, you know. I don't think this stuff that's like liquid is getting it, you know what I mean? So I went out and I bought about 200-300 of these little tabs, and next thing I know, I was peeling myself off the sidewalk and I ate Ashbury, you know. I was no longer functioning, you know. It was bells and bees and about 10,000 obscene buttons. And, you know, usually I tell what the buttons said, but Father is here, so I'll just... The one big yellow one on my leg said, fuck you, and then from there on you can take it for your imagination, you know. But it was very, very strange, that's all I can tell you, you know. For many years I looked like Donnie, right? Had long hair, big beard. Yeah, I got pictures to prove it, man, you know. But, what happened then is I explained earlier in the history thing about how I had these periods of coming and going through the first many years of my exposure to Narcotics Anonymous, and I got the message in very strange ways. You know, I bipped in and some smiling guy was still there shaking hands, and I'm like, my God, that guy was there 2 years ago and he's still clean. I couldn't believe it, you know. The other things that happened to me like that was that I would hear things that were said in the program, like, this is a way of life. This is a fellowship. This is a way of life, right? And then I'm loaded up, bombed out on my ass up there somewhere in San Francisco, and I'm listening to one of these all-night free radio stations, and the guy's talking about subcultures, you know, talking about all the different kinds of subcultures. And my mind went, oh yeah, that's what's going on with those people in that program. They're a subculture, you know. And so, you know, there was a little light bulb that went on somewhere out in the obscure land of no-no, you know. And another time I was expressly sick, you know. I mean, that's me and some other guy that I had drugged to the program a couple of times, but we were out using very, very heavily, and we decided we were going to stop. And, you know, there was no treatment centers in those days. I mean, that was an unheard of thing. It was like you either got a little dolophine or you grabbed your ass and hung on with both hands like the Chinaman does, and, or you, you know, took hot and cold showers or something, you know. But we were really sick. So we went and got some of this stuff called terpenhydrate with codeine, and we were out there drinking that stuff like they drink tequila, you know, just taking a bite of lemon with the salt and going, oh my God, I mean, that stuff is terrible, man, it's nasty, you know. And this guy looked over at me as I'm taking a chug on this stuff and he said, one is too many and a thousand never enough. Right? Another little light bulb went on. You got to understand that I kept coming back off and on all these years, so little by little, these little bits of information begin to make sense. And, you know, I mean, I've been around here well over a dozen years, and I saw a guy get a birthday cake. And I told this other person, I said, what's that? What's that for? I mean, can you imagine? I'm here over a dozen years. I don't even know people got birthday cakes. And they're telling me, well, this guy got a year clean and sober. And I said, well, he looks like a big dumb monkey, man. Anybody can do that. I said, well, shit, I really start feeling like there was hope. You know, right? And I don't like the guy anyway. He was a real rube, man, you know. So I just kind of thought, wow, man, maybe you win this. But, once again, I'm doing my knick-knack paddywax, and one day I came in a meeting, and there was a guy that I saw there. He looked like somebody I thought was a snitch. And so he'd come around the table, and I'd go around the table the other direction, because I thought, well, shit, this guy's probably writing my name down or something, you know, right? But about a week later, this guy came by, one of my, I'd just written a hot check and bought another one of these stools to cut hair on, and you gotta understand, I mean, I was very strange looking to be working in a barber shop, you know. So, but anyway, there I was anyway, and this guy came in and he started talking to me, and I was very, very sick. Fact is, I was laying on the floor throwing up all over myself and praying to the devil, and instead in came a member of Narcotics Anonymous, because I thought I had tried all this stuff. And you know, in the movies you see this stuff about where you could sell your soul to the devil, and so I thought, well, God, I tried everything, man, and I'm just sick. But anyway, in came this guy from Narcotics Anonymous, and he picked me up, took me down to a restaurant, and Father was talking about in those days when you had marks, you know, it was a straight ticket to jail. And I had marks all over me, all fresh. And this guy's got me in this coffee shop, and it's sort of down towards the back, and it's in a semi upper class part of the town. And he's talking to me, and he's asking me, well, where do you feel like using? Close your eyes and tell me, where do you feel like using? And I closed my eyes, and I said, out here. And he went, asshole, at the top of his lungs in this restaurant. I went, oh, Jesus Christ, man, you know. Look at this guy. He says, I said, where did you feel it? You know, I said, where do you, when you feel like using, where do you feel it? Now close your goddamn eyes and tell me where you feel it. Close my eyes. And I said, well, I feel like it's pushing on my head. And again, he starts screaming at the top of his lungs, you know. And by this time, I'm in this booth, you know, and I'm getting a little lower and lower in the booth, you know. I think, wow, you know, this is an experience. I wanted to get up and run out, except I figured somebody must have called the police, and if they see me running out of here, they're going to think I robbed the place, and then I'm gone. You know what I mean? I'm history, because I got marks all over me, you know. So, now by this time, this is two times down, right? And he's getting my attention, you understand? He tells me again, you know. With that again, he's screaming, he's hollering, he's on, you fucking idiot, you asshole. He's up, he's waving his arms, you know, and he's screaming at the top of his lungs, you know, asshole, asshole, asshole. I go, oh my God, I'm melting into the seat, you know. I said, he's telling me, close your eyes. I told him, I'm going, oh man, I said, what, where? Oh, Jesus, man, I know I want to use now, you know, right? I mean, it's like, now if I could only get loaded, I mean, if I had a fist, maybe I could handle this, man. And I'm thinking about that feeling, you know, and I'm going, oh, yeah, here, yeah, I feel it here. He said, that's it. You know, I said, oh, you know. I said, wow. And then he proceeded to tell me his story. And you know, I was afraid to get up and move out of this booth. I went, really? And he started off with this thing about, well, this is a program of total abstinence, you know. And like I told you before, I mean, I've been around a long time, and I heard everything the way I thought I heard it. Said, easy does it. I swear, folks, I thought that meant, they said you didn't become addicted in one day, so easy does it. I figured, shit, man, we don't rush this thing. We just kind of ease into it, you know. And you know, weekends. And so, you know, I mean, I stopped shooting stuff, started dropping hands full of reds, you know. And I go to a meeting, and I'm sitting there going like this, you know what I mean? They come up to me and go, Bill, how you doing? I'm doing good, man. I just smoked a little weed, brought some pills, shit, and they turn around and walk away from me, and I'm just standing at the, boy, these people are fucking unsociable, man. Man, see, like I had never felt like a part of in my whole life anyway, so not feeling a part of there just was, I didn't know it wasn't all right not to feel a part of Narcotics Anonymous. You know what I mean? So, after all this time, this guy tells me about this is a program of total abstinence. And I tell him, well, what do you mean? What is that? He says, you don't take anything. He says, you don't take any pills. You don't smoke any weed. You don't take anything, you know? I was horrified. I said, you don't take anything? Nada. Nothing. I went, holy shit. You know? And I had to think about it, but I kept listening to this guy's story, and, he really was a hardcore addict, you know. And besides that, I could tell he was nuts, you know. And I thought, Jesus, man, if anybody, I mean, maybe this guy, and he had about four and a half years clean, and I was really sparked by that, you know. So I told him, I says, hey, will you be my sponsor? And he said, I'd be honored to be your sponsor. He's honored? You know, I thought, this is an honor? You know, I thought, wow, maybe I can get the keys to his car or something. I'm right away, my head's working on that one, man. He's honored, you know, like, how much is this worth? You know? And, but he was cool. He was always, you know, his name was George. George was always one step ahead of me, man. And then he used to tell me all these great big pearls of wisdom, and I thought, geez, this guy is far out. And then later I start reading in the books, you know, and of course in those days there wasn't any basic text, and there was these little tiny pamphlets around, and we didn't have to read some of those books from the other fellowship. And then I keep coming across these pearls of wisdom. Then I always felt cheated. You know, I thought, that son of a bitch ain't as smart as I thought he was. He read that here in this book. You know, right. But it was all right because he had me on a little run there of not using, you know. Day at a time. One day at a time. No. And for me, he right away told me, he said, one day at a time is not good enough for you. You're too stupid for that. He says, for you, it's seconds and minutes. So I want you to repeat these words after me. And then I want you to repeat them to yourself throughout the day. And he said, first of all, I don't want you to tell yourself any lies like, I don't need to use, or I don't want to use, so I want you to just say, I will not use right now. With the accent on the word now. And he says, if you want to use, 10 seconds later, tell yourself that again. I will not use right now. And the way he equated it to me, he was a great storyteller. Equated it to me in very simplistic terms. He said, if the police are beating the shit out of you and they want you to rap, he says, can you hold your mud for a few minutes? I told him, sure. Because that's all there is to it. He says, just don't do it, man. Just hang on. And so it all started off with minutes and seconds like that for me, you know. And I grew to understand the understanding of total abstinence. And I was, you know, I was very warped. I remember going to meetings with other people, and then I was asked by some people, to go to some jails to carry the message. And I can remember one night in particular with a couple of people. We stopped at a restaurant on the way back, and my mind was, I mean, I space out now and I have to have people pick me up because I still get mind warps that I still attribute to drug usage even after all these years. I mean, I think I burned a few too many brain cells, or maybe I never had them to start with. Who knows, you know. But at that time it was worse because I couldn't even finish a sentence, you know. I mean, I was still talking like I was blowing weed, you know. I mean, I had three conversations going and one paragraph of talking, you know. And I'm asking these guys, hey, do you think I stand a chance of making it? And I just remember, just as clear as hell, you know, Bob Barrett, Chuck Skinner looking over at me and saying, just laugh. They just giggled. They didn't even give me the courtesy of an answer, you know what I mean? They just laughed at me, you know. And so I just kept coming back. And I kept taking directions. And that's what this one, the guy told me. He said, are you finally willing to take directions? And he told me a few things that I don't think that you normally hear around a program. But one was, he told me, if you got a problem, I want you to tell me if you've got a problem, but I don't want you to tell me what your damn problems are, because I got enough problems of my own. He said, so you tell me if you have a problem with your family life, if you have a problem paying your bills, just tell me that, and I'll tell you how to work the steps. And then you work the steps and you solve your own damn problems. And he said, you'll be able to do that. And that appealed to me. That appealed to me a lot. Because I really wasn't coming to have somebody tell me, well, the way you don't use is to play basketball or chop weeds in my backyard, you know. Which there was some of that going on over in some people's camps. And I just didn't think that I needed anybody to tell me when to take a hot shower or to do any of these kind of things like that. So I was really grateful the guy was telling me in the way he was, because I did have that desire to be an independent living man and make some kind of decisions for myself. Little did I know that as I went along working this program or working on the concept of powerlessness, that it would really, that would be the only decision that I ever really needed to make. The rest of it all just kind of falls into order, whether it's business or whatever. I just do whatever it is I know I'm supposed to do when I'm supposed to do it. And all that kind of happens automatically. But the only real decision I have to make is whether to work the steps on it. You know, he taught me to fight the battle of addiction out here, not to wait until it was all about, hey, you want some stuff, you know, right? It was all about, well, I have some feelings, and I'm powerless over my feelings, because the feelings trigger thoughts, and the thoughts trigger feelings, and the both of them cause me to have actions and reactions, and then I was in a world of trouble. So my new actions and reactions began with, I'm powerless, my life is unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, which really, that's the only place that it talks about recovery in the 12 steps, you know. That a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. Then the rest is a guideline for living. I was making a big deal out of this God thing, and I told him, well, I don't know if I want to turn my will and my life over to the care of something that I don't understand. So he said, well, let me explain it to you this way. He said, if there was a God, would you let him? I said, well, certainly. He said, that's all there is to that. Now, get out of your way and let him. But I was still, you know, you got to understand, I'm just a hard-learning person, right? I still had to analyze it, work it around. So for 2 weeks, I'm out riding around in my car every chance that I get, and I'm going, I don't understand, I don't understand, I don't understand, I don't understand. I'm holding my head, I'm going, I don't understand. Oh, God, I don't understand, you know what I mean? Oh, I don't understand, I don't understand. And all of a sudden, I'm driving along this normally busy stretch of road, and the Foothill Boulevard out there in the San Fernando Valley, but it happened to be nobody was coming along, and I went, I don't understand, and I went, wow, I don't understand. But you see, what happened to me is that the awareness came that if there wasn't something for me not to understand, I wouldn't be having a lack of understanding about it. I mean, if it was a non-existent thing, then in fact, there wouldn't be for me anything for me not to understand. There's a lot of things. I don't know if you can grab that, but that was my first concept of God. Right? And from that point on, I've never questioned. I mean, all I wanted to know is, hey, is it real? You know, for me, that was real enough. I bought it, hook, line, and sinker. I thought about what George said. I said, yeah, take it, man. You know. And then I didn't want to do an inventory because I kept thinking about who I was going to have to tell it to. Right? I hadn't taken it yet. So one day I'm just going crazy, and I streak over to this guy's house, you know, and I walk into the house and I'm crying. He says, what's wrong with you? I said, I want to use. He said, just a minute. He got a pencil and a paper, and he said, write. I said, what, are you crazy? I said, well, I told you I want to use. I said, what am I going to write? He said, sit down and write, dear God, help me to write. So I did. Then he said, now I want you to write down everything you're grateful for until you come to whatever you're ungrateful for. You see, you got to remember, I was very sick at that time, so I said, well, I'm grateful for this, and I couldn't get to the second grateful. It just went right into, well, I ain't grateful for that, I ain't grateful for this, blah, 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 blah. And the next thing I know, a page or two ran out, and there I was, stuck with an inventory, and he was there. So I wasn't going anywhere. I had to read this sucker, man. And that's kind of like how I was introduced into the steps, you know. Something else pops into my mind because I told you I went there crying, and he gave me this bit of enlightenment and this instruction that helped to save me. Another time I was approximately 90 days clean, and we're riding in the car, and he's driving, and I'm looking out the window, and suddenly I felt so sad and so depressed. And I began to weep and probably started a sniffle or something. And, you know, and once again he looked over and he told me, God damn, what's wrong with you? You're crying again? What the hell's wrong now? You know. I said, you know what, George? I said, this program doesn't work for me. He said, what do you mean it doesn't work for you? He said, you're not loaded, are you? I said, no, but you don't understand, man. I said, I want to use. He said, where the fuck did you ever get the idea you weren't supposed to want to use? So did you ever hear anybody tell you that? I said, well, I don't think so. He said, well, man, you've been a dope fiend all your life, man. And you think you're not supposed to want to use? He said, we all want to use.